said at lunch today that there were five sessions from this class on green burial, and they all tie together, but they can also be standalone. So that means if you're here today, you don't have to come back for the rest. I'll quickly run through what they're about. They're posted up there on the faculty board. Today is a sort of general introduction to thinking about the subject of death and setting a larger context, green burial. And tomorrow we'll see a film called Flight from Death, The Quest for Immortality, which is produced by the Ernest Becker Foundation in Seattle, and basically argues that death denial is the one way to understand almost everything in our society. We'll watch the film, and then we'll have a discussion of it, whether we agree with it or not. Then the third day, which will be Thursday, we'll look at another film called A Family Undertaking. And that is about home funerals, home burials, people, it's about people taking complete charge of the funeral process themselves and bypassing the professions, the morticians, the cemeteries, and so on. Then on Friday, we'll finally get around to more explicitly about green burial. I'll talk about the experience my wife and I had in Germany in 2007, where I first learned about this subject and started thinking about it. And we'll define the terms and the practices, especially in Europe. And then on the final day, Saturday, we'll talk about the green burial movement in the United States, and especially in the Pacific Northwest, what has happened here in the last couple of years. We'll ask whether or not this is the beginning of a much larger movement, not only in the Northwest, but on the West Coast and in the whole country. So that's the schedule for the week. First of all, today I'd like to just give you some personal background. I taught at Fairhaven College at Western Washington University in Bellingham for 26 years. And Fairhaven almost never taught like this. Fairhaven, basically, the maximum class size at Fairhaven was 20 students. And virtually all the classes were run in seminar style. And we'd be sitting around a table or around in a circle talking instead of having the professor at a podium or a lectern. And during those 26 years, one of the classes that I developed and taught repeatedly was called Death and Dying. That's a very good example of what was possible at Fairhaven that would have been totally impossible if I taught in, say, the history department. I'm a trained historian. If I taught in the history department, I could never have taught a class called Death and Dying. Even the history of death probably wouldn't have been vetoed by the department. But at Fairhaven, the emphasis was on interdisciplinary classes, connecting different subjects, bringing things together. And so that was possible. It was a 5-credit elective class. And of all the classes I taught, including introduction to mountaineering, basic mountaineering, including a courses on the Grand Canyon, which included hikes in the Grand Canyon, of all the classes I taught, none was as exhausting as the death and dying class. And I think the reason, I thought at the time, I still think the reason for that was the intensity of the subject. The intensity of the students, the subject matter, and I think how you can't think about death, the end of our lives, without some kind of intense concentration and involvement. It's very hard to talk and think about death and say, oh, it's just another subject, or it's boring, whatever. So, I taught that class with no formal training in the subject. When I was a student at the University of Puget Sound, I suppose this is where some of the interest came from. I was a student at the University of Puget Sound, and for 2 years I was a student pastor at Tumwater Methodist Church near Olympia. And during that time, I had to do several funerals, including, one I remember most intensely, I did a funeral for about a six-month-old child. And I look back and I think, how in the world could anybody do that? I was about 19 years old at that time, doing funerals for older people, for a child, and so on. At this point, it seemed incredible. But it created my interest in this subject. At UPS, I at one point took a course in the psychology of religion and studied about bereavement and grief. The next interesting thing is that after I graduated there, I went to a theological seminary, got a Bachelor of Divinity degree, and in the 3 years of that training, there was not a single thing about death, funerals, grief, bereavement. It seems very strange if you're training potential ministers to not have anything about the end of life or funeral services. However, I was at the University of Chicago at that time, and I could there take courses in the School of Medicine. And just by chance, one of the faculty in the School of Medicine was a woman named Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, who had just published a book called On Death and Dying, which was one of the first books to come out to try to look and understand the psychology of bereavement. And for a long time, it was still sort of considered a classic statement about the five stages of grief. So I did become familiar with that. Graduated, taught for 5 years at Olympic College in Bremerton, and then went to Fairview College in Bellingham and started teaching the death and dying class. And I did it initially because I just wanted to review my own interest in the subject, and the best way to learn about something or to study it again is to teach about it. You learn much more teaching than you ever do as a student. So I thought, well, I'll put this out there, and if anybody's interested can join it. Originally, it was just a short two-credit class. I thought I might get a few students to join me, basically on a set of readings. Much to my surprise, about over 20 students enrolled in it. And we got through that little short quarter, but after that, then I developed it into the 5-credit class, and it always enrolled full enrollment every time I taught it. The texts for the class varied over the years, but these were the main ones I used. The first thing I would have the students read would be Plato's writings and the Apology about the death of Socrates. I'd read about the death of Socrates and then read the Gospel of Mark. And after that, we'd have a discussion comparing those two figures. Demonstrating Jesus and Socrates and their death and the stories of their death. Following that, we usually read Tolstoy's The Death of Ivan Illich. Another required book was Kubler-Ross's book that I just mentioned. After it came out, I used a book by Sherwin Newland called How We Die. which, by the way, is in the bookstore over here. And it's an excellent book about the biological medical processes of the main ways in which we die. There's a book by Jessica Mitford called The American Way of Death, which was an attack on the funeral industry at the time. C.S. Lewis, The Grief Observed, is another textbook. Elie Wiesel, book Night, about the living through the Holocaust. Becker's book, The Denial of Death. But those are, I require five of books like that, and then the students had to read five books of their own choice, whatever they wanted to pursue. So at the end of the course, this is a quarter-long course, 10 weeks, they've read at least 10 books. Some of the students by the end of the course would have read 15 or 20 books. Again, I think that testifies to the intensity of the subject. Trying to get students to read 10 or 15 books in a typical college class is quite a challenge. But in this subject, they wanted to read. We would see a number of films. One of the films I almost always show was a film called Night and Fog, which is a French film made in the 1950s about the Holocaust. I still think it's the best film ever made about the Holocaust. And the purpose of that was to look at not just individual death, but to think about mass death. Sometimes people die in great numbers, very quickly. How is that different? What do we learn from that? Something I think be of interest to you is that one quarter I had a student enroll in the class. Her name was Ellen Weinberg. She came from Chicago. She actually lived in the Hyde Park neighborhood where I lived and I went to the university. She came to Fairhaven College for some reason, and she took the Death and Dying class from me. And after we read the Gospel of Mark, she was also at that point a very bright, well-educated student, but she came up to me afterwards and said, "That's the first time I've ever read anything in the New Testament." And Ellen went on, after she graduated from Fairhaven, she became, I think, the second woman to graduate from the Hebrew Theological Seminary, and one of the first, second or third female rabbis in the United States. Then she got a synagogue in Chicago. In the year 2000, she became the president of the Chicago Rabbinic Council. And about a year ago, she was elected the head of the Reformed Judaism National Worldwide Body is. She is the head of that. One of the first exercises I give the students in the class was to say, go home tonight or go get out of the classroom, go pick up the daily paper and go, take a highlighter and go through the paper and highlight everything in that paper that has to do with death. And I did that with this the Dillingham paper. I just grabbed this before we came over here. Just randomly went through it, page right, just the first section, which isn't very long in the Bellingham Herald anymore. It's only 10 pages. And there are 16 things about something about death. And that's doing it very fast. I probably could go through it and find a few more. And on the front page, there's this story about the drilling explosion in the Gulf, killing 11 workers there. And there are stories about war, there's obituaries. My point was that we are constantly, death is constantly happening in a whole bunch of different ways. And we usually read about it and just sort of, it goes right past us, we ignore it. But it's a constant and major part of our lives. And that, in fact, if it wasn't, we would be in a lot of trouble if things didn't die. If things didn't die, we wouldn't be here. So, anyway, that's what the class was about. I'd like to give you a little exercise. If you were just imagine you were teaching this class, what would be some of the subjects you would want to cover in the class? And remember, it's a class about death. It's a great, broad, interdisciplinary subject. It's not a class just about funerals or mortuaries. What would be some subjects you want to include in that class?
Maybe funeral rites across cultures.
Okay. I put down anthro, the anthropology of funeral, okay. Worldwide funeral rites. You could easily spend an entire quarter on that subject. There's tremendous variety, not only in the world today, but also through time. So the anthropology of different ways in which different peoples and cultures deal with the subject. What else might you put in the class?
Prolonging of life.
What?
Prolonging life.
Okay. Can we just put medicine?
Okay.
Preparation for death.
I realize medicine shows a bias there.
Talking about it, or the or denial, the prohibition on talking about it. A lot of people don't want to talk about it.
Okay.
The ceremony that accompanies both burial and also, like, when a person is dying, like in different cultures, I guess there's a, you know, sometimes there's a ceremony accompanying that person through death.
Let's just say rituals.
Yeah, rituals.
And that breaks down both into cultural rituals, but also personal ones,
yes.
Family ones, or whatever.
Yeah. When we talk about being burial, or what are the options? For actual burial, what are the legislation and rules across the country that limit you or allow you that choice?
Burial options and practices and so on.
Causes, why are we dying? Disease versus accidental death versus probably tied in with that grief, you know, with our different kinds of death easier to deal with than others.
Is there something else?
Okay,
you barely scratched the surface. Just read down the list of things that were included in my class when I taught it. One thing became obvious is that the class could not come close to covering everything. You know, some of these are up here, so notice which ones we've thought of so far, which ones we haven't thought of. The psychology of death, that would be like grief, bereavement, and so on. But the psychology would also cover what we're doing right now. How do we think about it in advance? How does it affect our daily lives? You'll see in the Becker film, if we choose not to think about it, our psychology is basically that of denial or ignoring it, at least from Ernest Becker, that has a tremendous impact on our lives. The message being, you can't escape it. Deny it or not or face it, it is a constant part of our lives. Psychology, economics, what are the economics of death? What is the funeral industry? How does it operate? How does it make money? Does it charge too much? Is it worth it? And so on. All those questions. Something somebody hasn't mentioned yet, but this is very obvious to think about it. Wills. What is a will? How do you draft a will? What should be in a will? What's going on legally with that? I'd always have an attorney come to class to talk to, who specializes in estates, come to the class and talk about making a will, which makes him very remote to 20-year-olds. But except then I remind them, you may think this is a long ways away. What about your parents? And what do they need to be thinking about? Do your parents have a will? One thing I found out in doing that is, this is a number of years ago now, but I've been told it's still the case. Well, the attorney I had come to my class, who was my own attorney, who drew up my own will for my wife and I, did not have a will himself. And he said over half of all attorneys over 50 years old do not have wills. That leads to the question we discussed, why have a will? Or should you have a will? If you don't have a will, what effect does that have? Another subject is animals. How do we think about the death of animals? When I taught a fair with this time, we had something called the Bridge Project, which brought in retired people to live on campus and take classes. So sometimes my class would look sort of like this group here today, or at least I often have two or three people in the class who were 65, 70, 75 years old, which made the class much more realistic in that way. But I found many of the younger students, one of the questions I ask is, what has been your most intense experience with death? When has death come closest to you and touched you the most? And the vast majority of the younger students would talk about the death of a pet as being the strongest experience they'd ever had with grief and the sense of loss and that. There are actually articles now, you can look them up, on the bereavement people go through when a pet dies. Pat and I were in Germany last year after our dog had died, and we were telling a friend over there about his dying. We were talking about it, and our friend, as we talked about it, started to cry. And her dog, her pet, had died 5 years earlier. But just talking about the death of our dog brought back a flood of memories in relationship to that dog, and she started crying. Religion, how does the Christian religion, the Jewish religion, world religions look at and think about death? Usually spend a whole quarter on that. Philosophy and philosophers. World cultures, which we have on the list, on the board. Literature. You take an entire quarter and just read books where the main subject is death. All the way from murder mysteries to books like Tolstoy's Death of Ivan Illich. Like in most of the great really great literature of death comes up one way or another. Shakespeare, all the great writers are usually dealing with it in some respect. Literature, theater, plays about it. The semantics of death, how do we deal with it in our language? Food. We cannot eat, even if we are vegetarians or vegans, we cannot eat food without it in some way involving the death of other things, at least maybe even the death of plants if we're vegetarians or vegans. But even in the harvests of grains and so on, animals, insects, birds, and things are often killed in that process. Food involves things dying. War and mass death, something like the Holocaust, sociology of death, suicide. Why do people commit suicide? How do they commit suicide? And what does that say to them? How does it affect the survivors? How do you get yourself to a state of mind where you decide to end your life? And going along with that is another side, homicide. Why do people commit murders? Why do people kill other people, including other family members? Coffins, near-death experiences, what's going on in those? And I would usually try to get somebody to come to the class who had had what they thought was a near-death experience. Music. One of the fun things I did in the class, I would have, we'd take an evening session, it'd be about two hours long, on Tuesday evenings. And I would, if this was a class, I'd say, well, next Tuesday I want you to come to class and each of you to bring a piece of music that speaks the most to you about, says the most to you about death. I don't care what it is, what kind of music it is, it can be classical, pop, rock, whatever, but you pick out some music which you think at this point is really important, says something very important or resonates with you about the subject of death. They would each bring it, and I'd say, you only have 3 minutes to play part of your selection. We'd go around and say, also, no, there'll be no critiques. We're just sharing this. We're not going to critique or react to other people's choices. We'd go around the class, and we would play their piece of music, and we'd just listen. And then another class session, we do the same thing with poetry. Bring a piece of poetry, which is really powerful for you about this subject. What are the taboos about death? What kinds of things can't we say in polite company that we can talk about in the class, but what can't you go home and talk to your parents about or to your friends? We've got the medicine, study of medicine and death. Survivors. How do we understand, or how do we understand ourselves if we're widowers or widows? And what's the whole psychology of that? How is that different from other family members? Once I taught the course, one of the books that have students read in the class, I think the title was just Widow. It's written by a woman whose husband had died fairly young, and she was a widow, and talked about that experience. And another subject, this can go on and on, but a final subject is capital punishment. If you believe in capital punishment or not, if you don't believe in it, why not? If you believe all right, what are the rationale for that? Or why is that, for many people, such a controversial those are the kinds of things that can be covered in a class called Death and Dying. I brought some books today, which I are more recent than when I taught the class. Just give you some recommendations. I haven't taught this class since 1994. Here's some recent books which I highly recommend if you want to do some reading or thinking about the subject. This one's called The Four Things That Matter Most, a book about living. The author's name is Ira Byock, who's an MD. Pat, did you say you saw this in the bookstore?
Yeah.
This is in the Holden bookstore. The Four Things That Matter Most. Advice from a doctor about the bases you need to touch, the things you need to do before you die, especially if you know you have a terminal disease. Often we avoid these things or go into denial and don't do what he says are extremely important things to get done, both for ourselves but also for our for those who survive us. Another excellent short, but this is a very short introduction, it's called The Sacred Art of Dying, How World Religions Understand Death. And it covers Christianity, Judaism, Hinduism, Buddhism, Islam, all the great world religions. What are their death rites, but it's more important, how do they look upon what is death and what follows death? What's going on in this process? There's a huge amount of literature on that subject. This is a very excellent, very quick introduction. The author's name is Kenneth Kramer. Here's another book I saw in your bookstore. The Last Lecture. This is a couple years ago. This is on the bestseller list for weeks and weeks. Author's name is Randy Pausch. He was a professor at Carnegie Mellon University. He found out that he had an incurable disease. He had about 6 months left to live. He was about 40 years old, a couple of children, and he knew he was going to die. But as he went through that process, he wrote this book. It's kind of like a diary. Last lecture refers to what he was supposed to deliver at the school on his retirement. It turned out to be literally the last lecture. But this is mainly his thinking about anticipating his own death, which is another question. How do we, if we're told we have a terminal disease, how do we handle that? How do we handle that? Or is it possible to handle that in a healthy way? What are unhealthy ways to deal with that knowledge? I think this is an excellent book to read to begin to think on that subject and about how we ourselves would do it if we were in his place. There's another best-selling book of a couple of years ago. Joan Didion, The Year of Magical Thinking. Her husband died very suddenly and unexpectedly one day, and this book is, again, kind of like a diary. It's about her handling her husband's death for the first year after he had died. And the title's a bit misleading. I avoided reading this book for quite a while, but I took the title literally and thought this is sort of a feel-good book or something. It wasn't very magical at all. It was a very hard year, which she described, with a lot of personal crises in it, and ups and downs. She's an excellent writer and careful thinker. This is a good book for how to survive, or at least what's going to happen if somebody very close to you dies unexpectedly. final book I brought today is The Jewish Way in Death and Mourning. The author is Maurice Lamb. And without going into the details that you can get in this book, I'll just say my conclusion is that in general, there are always exceptions, but in general, Judaism is much closer to what a modern psychologist would tell us is a healthy way to handle death and bereavement. In Judaism, it's not slam bang and it's done after 3 days or after the funeral. There's a long drawn out process. The burial happens much faster than in the Christian religion, either within a day or so. But then at various stages, after 10 days and after a month and after so many months and then after a year, there are ritualistic ways of coming back and revisiting and re-experiencing the death. That avoids I think, for especially for the families, the feeling that they've died, they're buried, and everybody's forgotten about them. It really stresses remembrance, active remembrance, instead of just putting it on a shelf somewhere. Okay, been talking about the course, but I've mainly been trying to just introduce you and start you thinking about this, the larger subject of death. Well, from what I've said so far, what would you guess were my goals in this class as a professor? Also remember, this is a state university.
To talk about it. To put it out on the table and actually talk about it.
Mm-hmm. Why?
Instead of hiding it away or denying it.
Why talk about it?
Make the options known.
Okay.
This should be a normal part of the life, like in other cultures.
Mm-hmm.
Just sort of flows. My husband says we're dying the minute we're born, we're dying.
Get past the taboos and reluctance to talk about something that's important, but also on a very practical level, to think ahead, to plan. Again, that may seem very remote to a college freshman or sophomore to start thinking about death. But anything that's remote to them, they have parents and grandparents. And it's going to come up at some point. And in my experience, the most thing I've read is as difficult as death and dying are for all of us, both personally and for people we love and cherish, it is even more difficult if you don't think about it and do some planning in advance. And if nothing else, you owe it to those who survive you to, well, one for one thing, having made a will, but also told them what you want done in certain cases, like a living will. My mother died, I think, at age 91. She was in a rest home for months. She got to the place where she was sleeping 22 hours a day. She barely recognized, when she did wake up, she might or might not recognize us. Honey, the doctor, her physician came, my brother and me one day and said, she's only living because we're constantly hydrating her. We want us to disconnect the dehydration system, putting water in. She was eating virtually nothing. First time he asked us that, we said, no, you can't do that. A few days later, a week later, whatever, We're back, the doctor's there again. My brother and I talked about it. He asked me, he said, do you want us to continue the hydration? And at that point, we said no. Pull the plug, however you want to put it, stop it. That was very difficult to do. There's no way that's an easy thing to do for your own mother. But what made it much easier than it would have been, she had made it very clear that's what she wanted. She made it very clear she did not want to be kept alive as long as possible, artificially. That made it much easier for my brother and I. In fact, one of the last things my mother said, I think you were there. She finally came conscious one day and she just looked at me and said, why can't I die? Mm-hmm. Anyway, planning ahead, anticipating things makes it easier. Or if you do funeral services for people, I've done funeral services. Been asked to do funeral services for people who I don't know. I'm doing it for the family or their friends. I know nothing about the person. I have to, often on very short notice, find out what I can to try to personalize it. If you do some of that in advance, you give the relatives or the minister or whoever some knowledge in advance about who you are, what you want, how you think about your life, your values, your favorite music, poetry, whatever, it makes it much easier for those who are in charge of your funeral. Any what other reasons there would be for teaching a class like this?
It fulfills one of the roles of teaching, and that's to challenge assumptions. And if there are no assumptions, challenge the student to think about the assumptions they have. In other words, to engage in critical thinking about a subject that society tends not to want to go to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, good. That's one of the major objectives.
It allows you to live. And I think that by talking about death and dying, it allows you to live in a more, less fearful way.
Or that probably depends a lot on the person.
Yeah.
There are people who can't really handle this for whatever reasons. But in general, I'd say being aware of our mortality helps us appreciate it more. Makes us appreciate being alive more. If you think you're act as if you're going to live forever, I think you don't appreciate the gift of life. There was something in one of our hymns the other night that we sang about that, about being very thankful for the gift of life, which means being aware of it. And being aware of death, the fact that it's going to end at some point for ourselves and for friends and relatives, I think should increase our appreciation. Anything else you can think of? What you'd be trying to do in a class like this?
Well, it would help showing us the commonality of experience. Everyone is going to die. Mm-hmm. So it's something that as people think about it and realize it, that this is a circumference that we all are part of,
mm-hmm.
which we're a part.
And I think the class had that effect on the class itself. The subject is so personal and so emotional in some ways that when you sat together for 10 weeks with the same group of people, talking about it, sharing about it, trying to understand it and understand each other where you're coming from, at the end of that time, there was often a real sense of community. I forgot to mention one of the things we did in the class, that's the field trips. you were teaching this class, what would you have for field trips?
Morgue.
Hmm?
The morgue.
Okay. Right.
The mortuary.
The mortuary. Well, first of all, we went to the mortuary and talked to a mortician. First couple of times I did that, I got really attacked by for using Mitford's book. How can we as taxpayers be support you for having students read this horrible book? Anyway, we talked to the mortician about the business and usually about embalming, all the things morticians do. And then we go to a cemetery. Just look at a local cemetery. A mausoleum. We had a field trip where we went to the Whatcom Humane Society. Why do you think we went there?
Lots of mercy killing.
You may think I'm a sadist or something. Yeah, we went there to watch animals being euthanized, to experience something dying immediately in front of us, and a dying. In many cases, because of human irresponsibility. My hidden agenda when I did that was, you know, I wanted an experience watching something die or be killed. My hidden agenda was, don't take a pet unless you commit yourself to it, or this will happen to it. At that time, we had students often living in the dorms. Christmas break would come, they'd leave the dorms and leave their pets behind, which they weren't supposed to have there in the first place. They just turned them loose. But anyway, we went to the Humane Society. Also, Fairhaven then had a program called the Outback, which was sort of an organic farm where they raised organic vegetables, but they also raised some animals. It wasn't a vegetarian farm. They would raise goats and pigs and things, and I'd arrange for going out and watching a goat or a pig be killed firsthand. We usually talk to somebody on the Lummi Indian Reservation, talk about the Lummi, go out there and talk about Lummi death and burial practices. Then the last thing we would do in the class, and this was not required, I didn't require students to go to the Humane Society, or at least to watch the euthanasia. But the last thing we did in the class, we'd go to an autopsy. And we'd go to Seattle, and it just wasn't right to do that in Bellingham because they might know relatives or friends of the person. But we'd go to Seattle, to the King County Morgue, actually, and watch an autopsy. And if all of you look very experienced here, but if the idea of death is still sort of unreal to you, something you can't quite believe really happens, that things really get to be dead, a sure way to cure that is to watch an autopsy. Death becomes absolutely real at that point. Normally, we'd go to the autopsy, and it would be an older person who died of a heart attack or in a rest home or something like that. And the students would gather around the table, and the autopsy would often take 2 or 3 hours, and they'd watch. And I'd usually stand back just to be sure, watching the students as well as the autopsy. Only once did I have a student faint. Standing behind her, she just felt like a tree being dropped, bam, like that. But we also, if you watch an autopsy, it helps to have a door and get outside occasionally. Get some fresh air. The things that get you is not just what you're seeing, but the odors. Anyway, the students can handle that pretty well. But we went to one autopsy, and the person they brought in happened to be 22 years old. He was a large guy, big, husky, athletic guy who'd been playing an intramural basketball game at the University of Washington. And somewhere in the game, he collapsed on the floor. By the time they got into the hospital, he was dead. And nobody had any idea how he had died. They brought him to the morgue for the autopsy. But the students had to watch an autopsy on somebody their own age, which somehow really got to them. A lot of them had a very difficult time with that one. They never did find out how he, at least in terms of the autopsy, he hadn't had a heart attack, he hadn't had a stroke. There was no sign of what possibly caused him to collapse and die on a basketball court. They were still going to do different kind of blood tests and so on for drugs or other things. I never did learn the cause of his death. But the fact of watching that process on someone their own age was extremely difficult for the students. And one final thing I was trying to achieve with that class is to get across the message of what we've been doing here today, that there's never any just one way to look at something. If you're going to try to really understand something, you've got to look at it in different ways. In this case, death. Look at it scientifically, you look at historically, you look at literature, you look at all the different things. And it's overwhelming. I hope you can tell today that there's just a huge range of ways to look at and think about death and dying. Burial, just one of them. Green burial is even a smaller part of that subject. I mentioned I would teach at Ferry and was on the Grand Canyon. And I'm not a geologist. Not only not a geologist, I've never had a geology class in my life. And everybody thinks about courses on the Grand Canyon, the first thing you think of is geology. But stop and think about it. What are the other ways to look at, try to understand the Grand Canyon besides geologically? If you think about it just a little bit, you can do the same thing we've done here. You find there are many, many other ways. There's the history of the canyon, literature about it, poetry about it, music about it, the anthropology, the ethnology, the hydrology, the politics of the canyon, dam building and the attempts to build dams in the canyon. What does it mean to be a national park? What are the problems of park management? All that stuff. And that's what we would do in the class. We'd have a couple of sessions on the geology, and I have a very good book, Layman's Introduction to the Geology of the Grand Canyon. But then we would go on into these different areas and look at, how else can we understand this really astounding piece of geography? So that's one of the things I was trying to do in the death and dying class, is show the importance of looking at things in a variety of ways. Finally, I'd like to conclude by this. I still got 2 minutes on this clock, which isn't the same as the kitchen clock. Or the porch clock. Just to set us up a bit for thinking about green burial. This is an article out of The Economist magazine a couple weeks ago. The Chinese government, the Hong Kong government, predicts that 50,000 new spaces for bodies, case, ashes mainly, 50,000 new spaces will be needed for the next 2 decades. In July, it named 11 sites for expanded places and said that a new one would be built near Shek Moon, the housing estate. But local residents are furious. Some worry about traffic, others that smoke and paper offerings will pollute the neighborhood. Most of all, they fear that disregarding Chinese culture, which holds that the living should not settle by the dead, that will bring misfortune. The territory's chief executive, Donald Tsang, has retorted that such objections amount to little more and a no graveyard in my backyard attitude. Yet objections continue to mount. And goes on and talks about the prices. If you get a really lavish, advanced kind of place to put your ashes, and it's almost entirely ashes, private prices can be high. A fee of $25,000 is common, compared with as little as $3,000 for public or government kind of spots, places. Anyway, it goes on and talks about there are going to be 50,000 places to put human remains, at least in the form of ashes. And that is part of the motivation and the concept behind the Green Burial Movement. We're asking the question, and this is a question I think I never asked in my class because it never occurred to me. What are we going to do with the bodies after some point? Are we going to run out of space for them? Or how much space are they going to take? And what else is that, what is that going to compromise? And as we'll see as we go on this subject, that in places where land is becoming more and more scarce, such as Great Britain or Germany where we were, people are having to think of other answers to that question, the question of space and land, than we've had to think about in the United States, where we feel land is extremely abundant. But where land is scarce, as in Hong Kong or Germany, it begins to create a problem of what do you do with conventional burial. Okay, now our hour's up. Okay, tomorrow we come, we'll look at the film Denial of Death, have a discussion of that.
That's the Ernest Becker Society film?
Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. If you watch it and decide you want to get one to have here at Holden for discussions and seminars, I can probably have a friend show you how to. From the foundation, the Becker Foundation.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.